is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. Taylor Schwenk is working from the Schwenk Studios back in Connecticut. I'm Buster Olney working from my home in Montana in the middle of the week. And Taylor, man, we got some huge news since our last podcast. John Sterling, 85 years old, announced that he's retiring immediately after calling 5,240 regular season games. He had taken a reduced role in recent seasons and traveled less often because of health concerns. But, you know, I checked around. John's a friend. You know, the years I covered the Yankees, Taylor, I love talking with him. And he's going out on his own terms, which is pretty cool. This is his decision. The Yankees wanted to work it out so he could continue to call more games, but John decided to step away.
You got to respect a guy who's like, I'm over it. I'm done. It's time to go home. It's time to relax. It's time to hang with my family. You know, I universally loved. I mean, that was the sentiment. And Buster, we're gonna play some John Sterling calls later. And I'll tell you, here's a secret about me: a good call in a stadium going wild, for whatever reason, and this shows what a freak I am, it makes me emotional. And I'm watching these John Sterling call last night. I'm watching Yankee Stadium go nuts as an Orioles fan, and I'm getting emotional because it's just, I love that energy. I love the feel that a good announcer brings to the game. So he will be sorely missed.
Well, I would say this. You said he's universally loved. I don't think so.
Okay, sorry. Not better. The Red Sox fans all came out. They were all out in your mentions yesterday, being like, who cares? No. And then they all played his bloopers. They sent videos of, you know, his, you know, he called 5,000 games or whatever. Of course, he's going to miss a couple calls. Whatever.
Well, and I've got some context on John Sterling as an announcer when we talk about him later and play some of his best calls. Our listeners, you know, did a great job in picking out some of the best ones that he had during a course of his career. All right, let's get to the games from Tuesday. The Brewers face the Padres in Milwaukee. The Brewers off to a great start, but you know what? The Padres are impressive, and they grab the game by the throat in the top of the first.
Second and third, one out, top of the first inning. Swung on, driven down the left field line, and well hit. Is it going to be fair? It is gone. Home run for Ha-Seong Kim. Padres with a 4-0 lead here in the first.
Yeah, from 97.3, the Fan. Dylan Cease was outstanding in this game. Six excellent innings. The Brewers got bad news before the game. They placed outfielder Christian Yelich on the 10-day injured list with a lower back strain. And by the way, Christian Yelich is going to join the show. And I would say this, Taylor, you'd back me up on it. We saw him on video. I don't think the back thing is like a big deal. I think this is a minor thing that he'll work through.
Yeah, if we could read between the lines here, he was unconcerned. We asked him about it, you know, because we didn't know if we should talk about it on the show or whatever. He was like, I'm going to talk to management after this. Unconcerned, wouldn't worry too much, Brewers fans.
No, I don't think so. And the fact that they didn't decide to put him on the injured list, they waited 3-4 days to do that, tells you this is kind of a, you know, a fringy type thing. So hopefully he's back soon. You're going to love what he has to say about hitting. Hembo had a great question for him, and Christian gave a great answer to that. The Braves faced the slumping Astros. Ronaldo Lopez threw six scoreless innings. He was dominant.
The righty deals. Well, wow. Put a gold star next to that one. Lopez strikes out one of the hardest guys to K, Jose Altuve, and he's done it twice tonight.
Yeah, so the Astros lose 6-2 in this game. Now, before the Braves game, they had to place Ozzie Albies on the injured list with a fractured toe. They don't expect him to be out long either, but obviously Ozzie, one of the mainstays of that Atlanta lineup. The Cubs placed outfielder Seiya Suzuki on the 10-day injured list before their game against the Diamondbacks, which was absolutely insane. Back and forth, the Cubs were behind, then they took the lead, and then this is what happened in the bottom of the 10th inning.
And now the 1-0 is swung on. That's it towards the gap. Diamondbacks are going to win it. Walker can walk home on the game-winning double. And Randall Grichuk, your hero tonight, as the Diamondbacks walk it off 12-11.
And from 98.7 FM Arizona Sports, the Blue Jays played host to the Yankees on Tuesday night. And Vladimir Guerrero Jr. gave the Blue Jays a lead in the bottom of the fourth.
Score, Varsho behind him, and it's a big two-run single for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
That was the Dan Shulman on that call on the Blue Jays television network. The Yankees would come back and make it close, but in the end, the Blue Jays holding on to win 5-4. The Mets faced the Pirates. Mets playing well lately. They took a 2-1 lead, and then Jeff McNeil padded that advantage.
Wendell down third, 2-2 pitch. McNeil pops one in the sky down the left field line, falling fast, base hit in the left field. Wendell scores from third. McNeil heading to second base with a stand-up double. The Mets add insurance. They've scored three times in the bottom of the seventh, and they lead the Pirates 3-1.
That from WCBS. The Red Sox had a pretty good lead over the Cleveland Guardians, 5-1 at Fenway Park, but then the Guardians would come back. They'd play into the 11th inning, and after Jose Ramirez gave Cleveland the lead, this is what happened.
The pitch. Swung and drilled into right field. That's a base hit. Jimenez scores. Ramirez coming home. Abreu throw to the plate. Not in time. Jimenez scores with a slide, and Esteban Florial's big week continues. He rips a two-run single to right. It's a three-run 11th inning, and the Guardians lead it 10-7.
It has been a rough homestand for the Boston Red Sox. That sound from WTAM 1100. The Phillies play the Rockies. Ranger Suarez has been one of the best pitchers in baseball since last August, and he had a milestone last night.
Breaking ball right back at him, and fittingly, Rangers got it. Turns, fires, and it's a shutout for Suarez. 5-0, Phillies win it as Rangers Suarez throws the first complete game shutout of the season by a Phillies pitcher, and just the second of his major league career.
Sports Radio 94 WIP. By the way, I should have mentioned this after we gave the Cleveland highlight. You know they got the best record in baseball, Taylor?
I was aware that they were toward the top, but best? Are you sure? Can Sarah Langs confirm that?
I think so. We'll have to get Sarah on Friday. I'm not going to look it up at the moment. Yeah, incredible start for Cleveland. The Phillies seem to be putting it together. Some sad news around baseball. We lost three really historic members of baseball history. Carl Erskine, who pitched two no-hitters with the Brooklyn Dodgers and was a 20-game winner in 1953, passed away at age 97. He was part of the Boys of Summer Brooklyn Dodgers, a teammate of Jackie Robinson, someone who was really cherished by all the guys on that team. Ken Holtzman, a left-hander, pitched two no-hitters for the Chicago Cubs and won three World Series with the Oakland A's in a 15-season career. Died Monday in St. Louis. He was 78 years old. This from the New York Times. He won 174 games, the most for a Jewish pitcher in Major League Baseball. Nine more than Hall of Famer Sandy Koufax, who's considered to be one of the best pitchers ever and who had a shorter career. Yeah, the Oakland teams that I couldn't stand when I was growing up as a kid, he was part of the big three. You had Catfish Hunter, you had Ken Holtzman, and you had Vita Blue. And Hall of Fame manager Whitey Herzog passed away on Tuesday at age 92. He managed the Kansas City Royals to division titles in 1976-78. But they lost each time in league championship series to the Yankees. In an 18-year career as a manager, he had over 1,200 victories. So three people who really were well-liked within the industry, Taylor.
Sad morning for the sport. I'm glad you could appropriately put their careers into context. One thing to mention here, a new episode of the College Game Day podcast, Field Yates on with the boys talking NFL draft. And also, I guess we should promote here. So we have Christian Yelich on the podcast today. And then on Friday, Rowdy Tellez, Pittsburgh Pirates, friend of Christian Yelich, which we discovered as we recorded those interviews.
Yeah, we did them back to back, which was fun. We talked to Rowdy first, and as he was finishing up, Yelich checked in on Zoom, and immediately those two guys were giving each other a hard time. Like, Yelich is all over Rowdy Tellez. Like, you could tell these guys had been on the same team together. They were used to giving each other a hard time. It was fun.
Christian tried to play producer and told us to cut Rowdy's last answer because he was so dissatisfied with it. And,
said too many cliches.
Yes.
You gave every cliche in the book, Rowdy. What's up with that? It was a lot of fun. It was a fun conversation with Christian Yelich coming up. We're driven by the search for better. When it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Hembo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
And Hembo is Paul Ambichetti's highest paid researcher in the world. Hembo, last week, we were hitting on some great baseball topics and having a lot of discussion there. And we really buried the headline from your life, because it was 2 weeks ago. We talked to you on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and then within hours after that, you posted on social media that you're going to be daddy to a third.
Daddy to a third. Buster, in August, we are having number three, and we are having our third girl. So you know how it is, when you're dating someone, when you're engaged to someone, you're talking about how many kids we want to have. And it's like, oh yeah, I think I'll probably want to have one boy, one girl, and be done with it. But you know, that's not how this stuff works. So on the first shot, we get two girls. We'll try for a boy and then be done. All right, so then we're having a third girl. I'm going to run out of girl names here shortly. So I don't know. Like, I don't have decision power here. Like, I just do what I'm told, basically, for topics this important in any marriage, as you might expect. I just do what I'm told. And so on a topic of import like this, I'll just say yes, or let me know where and when. But in this case, Buster, baby number three. So my life is going to be absolutely crazy. So when you hear me talk about baseball in September and October, feel free to disregard, because there's a good chance I won't be asleep for 1 second to actually be able to process my thoughts. That's honest truth.
I can't even imagine. Yeah. Three daughters born within 2 years of each other. That's
what could go
really
wrong?
Aggressive.
What could go wrong?
Oh my God. But I remember talking to Bill Smith, the former general manager of the Minnesota Twins, because my daughter was at that time, I want to say 12 or 13. And Bill Smith had five daughters. Okay. And I said, Bill, what was that like? And because all of his daughters had grown, he said, it's the most amazing thing. They go into a portal when they're about 14 or 15, and they come out such wonderful people at the other side at like 22 or 23.
Portal. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that portal. Right now, I have not yet entered that portal, but there's going to be like years of my life that I look back on and say, oh yeah, I remember that. And right now, I'm in one of those years.
Yeah, good thing you're the highest paid researcher in the history of the world, right?
Super
you're
going to
be
helpful.
Coming for that deferred money in 126 years.
That's exactly right.
All right, you've got three declarations for early this season based on the results we've seen on the field. What do you got, number one?
Number one, Mike Trout is back to being Mike Trout, Buster. If you don't get ahead, he's making you pay. In even counts and hitters counts this season, Trout is slugging 935. All right, his career high in that stat is 863. So that's a super loud number in the early going. If you challenge him, he's going to make you pay. On pitches in the strike zone, he's put 40 balls in play and collected 40 total bases on those swings. That's a pretty good ratio. His isolated power in the zone is 500. His career high in that stat is 423. So if you catch my drift, you got to get ahead. But you got to nibble too. He's not leaving a whole lot of margin for error for poor pitchers. Mike Trout, if you give me 150 Mike Trout games, he's going to be an MVP finalist in the American League. If I had one wish to make, this is the wish I would choose. Mike Trout on a contending team the day after the trade deadline. I don't expect to get my wish, but based on early returns, we are going to see a vintage Mike Trout season this season.
Great minds think alike. I filed a piece on Sunday morning to ESPN with six early season observations, and one of them was Mike Trout is back. And the feedback that I got from talking with people within the Angels organization is he's back to wrecking fastballs.
Yeah.
You know, for years, the pitches at the top of the zone were his kryptonite, and now they feel like he's back to doing that. When we had Mark Gubazon doing the Angels preview, he said to us that Trout told him not only did he want to stay healthy this year, but he wants to get back to being the player that he's been in the past. All right, number two.
Number two, the Reds lineup is precocious. Cincinnati ranks third in the majors, Buster, at 5.8 runs a game. The what is impressive, but the how is even more so. So seven of their nine lineup regulars are 28 or younger, and they're creating runs on the bases. They lead the major leagues in average sprint speed. 41% of their base runners come around to score. That leads the majors. Got 32 stolen bases as a team. That leads the majors. And they take the extra base with 50% frequency. That leads the National League. We are living in a world now, Buster, in which you can generate runs, you can manufacture runs, you can create runs for yourself based upon the rule changes. And no team has been more cutting edge in that area than these Cincinnati Reds. And when you consider the fact that at some point this season soon, we'll see TJ Friedl, and then perhaps after the trade deadline, we'll see some more Matt McClain. This lineup is really, really dangerous. And I think they've improved their pitching enough to right now I can see a clear path for these Cincinnati Reds, these young Cincinnati Reds, to make the playoffs.
All right. So you've inspired me. When this podcast is over, I'm going to reach out to Nick Kroll, David Bell, and find out what the inspiration was behind all that. Besides the fact when you have, you know, obviously super fast guys who run the bases well. Number three.
Number three. The White Sox lineup is repugnant. Buster, these numbers are astonishing. They just became the first team to be shut out six times in their first 16 games of a season since the 1907 Brooklyn Superbas. Okay, so that was the Dodgers before they were the Brooklyn Dodgers, before they were the Los Angeles Dodgers. It's been a minute since a team started this slowly offensively. They've got an OPS of 459 with men on base. That's 100 percentage points worse than any other team in baseball in those situations. 119 base runners have scored 23 times. Their strand rate is 81%. They're impossibly bad. And lastly, I'm going to ask you to guess a number. In 144 innings pitched against the White Sox this season, Buster, guess what the league ERA is in those 144 innings.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to say it's under two.
It's exactly two. 2.00 in 100. Like, you know how people often say, like, oh, our lineup makes every other pitcher look like a Cy Young starter. Well, in the case of the Chicago White Sox, they actually turned the league average into Cy Young. 144 innings of a 2.00 ERA. That is the most unwatchable team in the whole sport.
Man, no wonder why they signed Tommy Pham. Like, at this point, they're just desperate for anybody who can hit. You know, and I'm sure he's going to be an upgrade over what they've done. Oh, so far.
He'll hit cleanup for them.
And they have three of their primary position players who are going to be out for an extended period. All right, yeah. Both you and I turned in hot takes for ESPN.com. Mine was about the Mets and watching them early in the season, saying that, you know, in watching their pitching staff, they are relying on these short-term veterans, guys who are on the team for 1 or 2 years and aren't going to be around. And then when you look at their farm system, they don't really have a lot of high-end pitching. The other day, I was talking with an evaluator who noted that right now, the most coveted resource in the sport is young, controllable pitching. The Mets really don't have much of that. And when you look at it, their position player group, you've got Francisco Lindor right in the middle of his career, Jeff McNeil, Brandon Nimmo, et cetera. And so what I wrote was, man, by the time they put together that pitching, then you might see the position player group on the downslide. It may be a bit before we see the Mets back in contention every single year. What do you think?
It may be a bit. I think you're 100% right. The Mets have played pretty good ball lately, but I think it's much likelier that the Mets are, if not sellers at the deadline, at least soft sellers at the deadline. You don't hire David Stearns unless you're at least planning on doing some kind of rebuild, whether it be all the way or whether it be modified. They're going to score some runs this season. There's too much talent in the lineup for them not to score runs. They've got some professional hitters and guys that are still at the tail end of their primes. But this pitching staff is pretty rough without Kodai Senga. We're talking about 80% of it in their 30s, and no one with real, actual frontline swing and miss stuff. So they're going to be, I think from a run prevention standpoint, really, really rough. And I'm curious to see if come trade deadline time, we're talking about Pete Alonso and perhaps even talking about Edwin Diaz, who could be an enormous boost for any number of teams at that point because of the role that he occupies. The question I would like to ask you is one of the very first things that David Stearns did in Milwaukee. And keep in mind, during his time in Milwaukee, that was a top 10 run prevention team in the sport over the course of about a decade. He drafted Corbin Burns. It was his first draft in 2016. Can you imagine a reunion between David Stearns and Corbin Burns in an offseason that also includes Juan Soto? I think that's going to be a hot topic of conversation by the time we get to the offseason. What say you?
That would help to turn around. No question about it. You know, it's interesting. Billy Epler gets a lot of criticism for his tenure. You know, they went out and signed Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander. That still, in this moment, may be their most their best path to getting back to relevance. You know what I mean? Competitively, that might be what they have to do, based on based on the age of some of their pitchers and where they are. And by the way, you know, yes, Senga's going to come back, but I've told you this before, that the reason why evaluators sort of shied away from him from some teams, and they all say, yeah, last year he was great, was that they were worried about a physical breakdown.
Right.
And it's not like it's been fixed. So
yeah.
You know, I don't think anybody can assume with Senga, just as we don't assume with Gerrit Cole, that you're necessarily going to get that guy back in the way that on 2023.
Basically need to build an entire pitching pipeline from scratch. I went back and looked at their system today, and the number of high-end pitchers that are anywhere near the big leagues are basically zero. I mean, you're talking about starting from scratch. Now, we don't exactly know what it's going to look like because we've never seen David Stearns actually have money. Once Andrew Friedman got to the Dodgers, we saw him spend his money wisely, or at least more wisely and more differently. And that's what we expect David Stearns to do in some sense. But I think if Mets fans are impatient, I think you might wind up being really disappointed because you can't build the kind of baseball empire that they want to in a year or two. Now, the difference between Milwaukee and the Mets, of course, is that if you can actually spend a lot of money on your big league club, you can do both. You can developmentally sort of reconfigure your system and create that pipeline while at the same time fielding a competitive club. But I'm not so sure that David Stearns is going to be interested in investing $200 million in Corbin Burns if they have a, say, 3 to 5 year plan. And you know as well as I do, who knows what that guy's going to look like in 3 or 4 years, because pitchers are pitchers. And without being able to control them cheaply, you basically stand no chance of sustainable success. So if I'm a Mets fan, I feel good about the fact that I've seen him do it before and do it in a small market. I don't feel good about the fact that it's going to happen right away.
Your hot take was about Anthony Volpe, the Yankee shortstop. What do you got?
Anthony Volpe will produce more value in his age 23 season than Derek Jeter did. Anthony Volpe is in his age 23 season. Derek Jeter's age 23 season was his second full season in the big leagues, and he was really good. About a league average hitter who ranked in the top five in both runs and hits, was a 5-WAR player. And I think 5-WAR is very much on the table for Anthony Volpe, and I'll tell you why. Number one, Anthony Volpe is already a better defender at the position than Derek Jeter ever was. That's not my opinion. It's a statement of fact. Anthony Volpe already plays up at shortstop, and that would be really encouraging for me as a Yankees fan because that's a baseline. If I'm getting good defense, and in his case, good base running, then everything that happens with the bat is just going to inflate that value more and more and more. And Buster, I have seen this guy wreck baseballs to the opposite field all season long. I watched him play a bunch of games in Cleveland over the weekend, just constantly pounding the ball off his barrel into that right center gap. And that is a thing of beauty when you consider his swing path. He's decided to go away from that nonsense last year, trying to tap into pull side power. He's going to try to split the gap in right field, go for doubles and rather than going for home runs, which absolutely plays up into his swing. I think Anthony Volpe is going to have like a 40 double season. Probably have another chance to win the Gold Glove again. I'm as high on him right now as I am on anyone in baseball taking a big year over year jump. The aptitude that he has shown me in the early going, he's going to have more than a 5-WAR season.
It's interesting because, as you know, he's someone who's demonstrated power. He's also demonstrated patience. And I remember when Derek, when I was covering the Yankees in 98, doing a story on him and asking Daryl Strawberry about, hey, do you think there's a year when Derek might hit 30 homers? And he immediately goes, no chance. And he basically said, because he's too impatient. Like, he swings the bat. He's super aggressive. And by the way, that he didn't mean it at all as a criticism of Derek. Mm-hmm. You know, he finished his career with more hits than anybody but five players in the history of baseball. But Derek was never going to be the guy that would learn how to back pitchers into a corner and then look for a pitch to hit. And, you know, when he's ahead in the count or with runners on base, and take advantage of that. Early signs for me is Anthony Volpe is absolutely that guy. As he gets older, I think he's going to hit for more power. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And the numbers back you up. The approach difference from his rookie season to his sophomore season is staggering. And that's the kind of thing that you look for in young players. It's one thing to be able to reach the big leagues, having done it the way that you've done it your whole life. But these are the best human beings on the planet. And they all have a staff of people that are designed to get you out. And year over year, Anthony Volpe has adjusted in terms of his approach, in terms of a swing, about as well as you could ever expect. And if you have that kind of, one, coachability, and two, athleticism, the sky is basically the limit for you. And when you run and you field as well as he has and can, I think you're looking at a monster season from Volpe, who will be their everyday leadoff hitter basically going forward, as far as I'm concerned.
We're going to be talking with Christian Yelich in a moment. You said as we got started, you had a question for him.
Absolutely. So Christian Yelich had a couple of ridiculously good offensive seasons, went from being like about as good a player as there was in the National League to a slightly above league average hitter. Well, right now he's hitting the absolute cover off the ball. He's about as good as there's been any hitter in the National League this year. What I've really noticed about Christian Yelich's approach this year, Buster, is that he's really tapping into his pull side power. What I'm curious about, because those numbers have skyrocketed, not just his effectiveness in doing so, but his approach in doing so in terms of the frequency, he is pulling the ball a lot more and a lot better than he ever has before. So I'm very curious, how intentional is that? Did Christian go back into the lab over the winter, look at the tape, look at the numbers, and say to himself, I'm going to be a better hitter this season by tapping into my pull side power more frequently? Because I'd imagine, as intelligent as he is, and as much as he showed that in the past, the answer to that question is very likely yes. But right now the numbers are jumping off the page. And so long as he continues to do that, I think another MVP or at least someone in that conversation is very much on the list of options for that guy.
All right, Hembo, your question will be the first we play for him. Thanks for doing it.
Later, friends.
Christian Yelich plays with the Milwaukee Brewers. Christian, thanks for doing this.
You got it. No problem.
Our researcher, Paul Embiketis, I joke he's the highest paid researcher in the sport. He was so excited when he heard that we were having you on, and he had a question for you. So please give a listen to this.
He is pulling the ball a lot more and a lot better than he ever has before. So I'm very curious, how intentional is that? Did Christian go back into the lab over the winter, look at the tape, look at the numbers, and say to himself, I'm going to be a better hitter this season by tapping into my pull side power more frequently?
Oh, I think that's a product of like you moving correctly and like your body doing what you want it to do. Because nobody can go up there and just be like, well, I'm just going to hit more for more pull side power. Like, you know, we're very talented, but players can't just be like, well, I'm just going to pull the ball in the air for home runs more because I want to. Like everybody wants to, you know, but you have to do that. In my mind, it's a product of like sequencing correctly, like your body moving correctly and your contact point kind of being where it needs to be. And that kind of like naturally translates into good ball flight, you know, and like when you're struggling or you have bad habits and stuff like that, you're not going to get the ball in the air to the pull side. Cause it's hard to do. Like if your goal, like you just go up there and like, I'm gonna hit fly balls to right field. Like you're going to be susceptible to a lot of other things if you're not moving correctly, if that makes sense. So I think that's all kind of a byproduct of when your swing is where it needs to be. And like you need, and you feel your best as a hitter. And obviously when I've been my best as a hitter, like that's what I've been able to do. And, you know, before dealing with some of this back stuff earlier, like I felt really good again. It felt familiar from obviously years past of when I've had some pretty good seasons, and hoping to get back out there and see if I can keep that going.
So one of the conversations with you that I'll always remember when you were a young player with the Marlins, I remember talking to you about whether or not you would hit for more home runs in your career. And you didn't think of yourself as a power hitter when you were younger. And mm-hmm. I remember you being really clear about that. Sort of how did that evolve as time went on, where you felt like you could do more?
I think that's kind of the natural evolution of a hitter. I think it's really good for young players to become good hitters first. And then once you become a good hitter and you start to understand yourself and the game and sequencing and situations and how pitchers are going to attack you, then you kind of tap into your power. At least that's what happened for me. I think a lot of times now, like people want to just skip steps and they just want to see power right away from really young hitters. And then that's where you kind of fall into that little trap of like, you're trying to hit for power, but you're sacrificing so much else, a lot of other things. And it kind of caps your ceiling as a hitter, I think, when you're kind of just selling out really young for power, unless that's just naturally part of your game. If you're trying to, you know, kind of artificially get to that, I think, you know, it slows your progression as a hitter, and it can make it difficult on yourself at times. And because hitting's hard, man. It's not as easy as being like, well, I just want to go do this, so I'm going to do it. You know, like, I know, like when we were talking about earlier, it was like, you're really successful when you pull the ball in the air for home runs. It's like, yes, but how do you do that? You know, like you can't just go up there and be like, I'm going to do this, because it's not as easy as that. Like, things have to happen correctly, and you have to understand like how that happens before you can actually do it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got to cover Tony Gwynn, you know, Hall of Famer, 8 batting titles. And what was interesting about him is that he was basically a singles hitter through like the first decade of his career. And then he got to about year 12 and he learned that there were certain situations where he got very adept at driving the ball. And all of a sudden he's hitting some home runs and he was hitting some doubles. And, you know, it was like he had to convince himself that he can make that transition. And this is one of the smartest hitters we've ever met. Yeah. For you, when did that start to take place? And what do you remember about the first times when you felt that?
I think it was probably like 2016-ish, 17, when I was with the Marlins still. You know, I'd had a few years in the big leagues at that point, and I'd kind of moved the ball around the field. You know, hit for a pretty high average. We get on base all the time. But for me, like in that ballpark at the time, like it's still a big ballpark. But back then, I mean, you remember when it first opened, like that place was ginormous, you know, and it wouldn't have been very beneficial for me to go up there and be like, well, I'm just going to try and launch. Cause another big part about being a good hitter is like, know yourself, right? Like, don't try to be something that you're not. Understand like what you do well and try to set yourself up for success with that. And then, as you progress in your career, like you were saying with Tony, is like you understand certain situations where you can take some chances, try to drive a ball. You're familiar with pitchers that you've kind of seen before and maybe know how they're going to attack you, or you kind of learn how to watch video a little bit. And just once you gain that experience, you kind of like, and then you understand like what has to happen for you to hit for power. And it's a learning curve. And, you know, I think the more you talk to scouts, when you talk to scouts, they tell you power is the last thing that kind of comes as a hitter. And I think that's kind of the reason, you know, unless like some guys are just really naturally gifted, right? They're strong. Like they've always kind of been power hitters, but guys that are just kind of hitters and then develop into power hitters later on I think that's kind of why, is like you understand yourself as a hitter and then you can kind of take that next step because you have the ability. It's just kind of then putting it all together.
Are there left-handed hitters with other teams that you will follow their plate appearances or, you know, look at their at-bats against opposing pitchers? I know a lot of pitchers like to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll have a lefty that's a lot like them or a righty that's like them, and they'll go and watch that. Are there hitters that you like to watch because you maybe do similar things?
Nobody in particular. Like, oh, well, when we're playing another team or something, like they usually always have like the starting pitcher on kind of a loop. And like, I understand like what I like to try to do as a hitter. And then I kind of watch the video of the pitcher and kind of see like how he's attacking guys, like where they miss, stuff like that. And you kind of formulate your game plan for the night with that, like how you're going to attack guys. And, you know, some guys are guys that you're like, okay, I can maybe, you know, take some chances tonight and drive the ball. Or other guys like, you know what, this is probably just a, you know, base hit guy. And then, you know, see what happens when the bullpen comes in and they're the next guy. And you start to learn yourself and learn guys like, okay, this might be a time where, you know, I could try to drive the ball a little bit, or, you know, maybe tonight's not the night for that. And, you know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't.
You guys have had stunning offensive production early this season. When did you start to see that, you know, come together?
I think late in spring. You know, we have a pretty athletic group, and it's a different version of baseball, I think, that we've played than like you've kind of seen in years past. There's a lot of bunting. There's a lot of running. It's using our speed and athleticism together, like trying to just put pressure on the other team throughout the game and, you know, just make teams execute and make teams think and use your skill set to your advantage. Like we were talking about earlier, it's like know yourself, right? If you know what kind of player you are, know what kind of team you are, and then try to leverage those strengths to your advantage and, you know, try to win games, because teams win in all kinds of different ways. It's like, I think what we've done a good job here with the Brewers over the years is like we knowing yourself as a team, and that changes every year. And then how are you going to leverage that to where you have an advantage and you're going to be able to win games, right? Because the way we play and the way another team plays could be completely different, but we could both be good. And we have a lot of young guys that are still kind of getting their feet wet and learning how to play, but it's been exciting. It's been fun to watch. And I think it's a fun way to play the game. And I think it's a way that you don't see all too often. You're starting to see it more now, I think, with the base running rules and the pickoffs and all that kind of stuff. So it's been really fun so far.
As you know, Pat Murphy was Craig Counsell's right-hand man. If you have favorite Pat Murphy story, because it feels like he's one of those guys who's been around where everybody knows him and everybody has a story about him to describe his personality. What about for you?
I mean, I love Murph. There's tons of stories. I don't know how many I can share like publicly, but he's awesome, man. You know, like anybody that's been in baseball for any amount of time has probably had a run-in with Murph, whether you've played with the Brewers or not, just because he's been in the game for so long, collegiately and in pro ball. And he knows all kinds of players. He knows players extremely well, and he's done a great job so far.
And last one, we're going to be talking with Rowdy Tellez. Give me a favorite Rowdy Tellez story after being a teammate with him.
Rowdy's a good guy, and he's a fun guy to have in the clubhouse. You know, keeps it light. He really talented player. You know, he can he really handles the glove well at first base. You know, around the bag, I think I've kind of noticed over the years of like he's a really good receiver of the ball, big target over there, and he can really hit. You know, he was on and off the field a lot with injuries last year, but when he's healthy, he's out there. You know, big threat in the middle of the order. And you know, we miss him for sure, but obviously always wishing him the best of luck in his career, just not when he plays us. And we gave him the nickname Big Randy somehow. I don't know how that he kind of just looked like a Randy one day and everyone started calling him Randy. He hated it. So then it stuck. So we all over here refer to him as Big Randy.
What did you, when you saw the tape last week of the way that he stepped in front of the cameras with his teammate, David Bednar, what was your instant reaction when you saw what he did there?
Yeah, I mean, it's about having each other's back, right? Over the course of the season, there's going to be those moments where it's tough. And baseball, you know, you fail a lot, but your teammates are the ones that kind of pick you up. And if you've been in the game for a certain amount of time, like you understand that there's going to be those tough times. You know, there's going to be moments where it doesn't go your way out there. And I think the good teams are the ones that kind of stick together and pick each other up, and they don't really let adversity, you know, phase them. You know, you got to understand that there's going to be adversity throughout the year, and each one of your teammates is going to experience that at some point. And going through it and getting through it together is a much better way than navigating it by yourself. And obviously nobody wants to fail. Nobody wants to feel like the reason that you lost the game that day was because of you. But in reality, like that's going to happen to probably all of us at some point throughout the course of the year. So when your teammates pick you up, it's a great feeling. And it was cool to see Rowdy do that.
All right, Christian, thanks for doing this. Always good to talk with you.
You got it. Good to see you.
We spoke at the top of the show about John Sterling making the decision to retire. And it's interesting. I you know, covered the Yankees for 4 years. And so I got to know John during that time. And I listened to him living in the New York area for 25 years. And when people would say, like, well, John Sterling is a big homer, it would kind of make me smile. And I'm sure that part of the reason why is because anybody who wasn't a Yankees fan hated Taylor, the game-ending call whenever the Yankees won. When I'm not even going to try to imitate it. Our former producer, Josh Macri, was outstanding at doing that. But you know, as an Oriole fan, that call that he made whenever the Yankees win a game, yes?
Yes, of course, of course. Someone tweeted, said, hey, can we get Josh Macri on to do the thing? Does it? He says, the Yankees. It's terrible, terrible.
Right. But, he would do that. So everyone would say, oh, what a homer. I can tell you this. If you actually listen to the broadcast of John during the course of a game and the Yankees didn't play well, he was blunt. Like, he could tell, you could tell when, it, you know, he felt like that they were not playing up to par. He would, you know, talk about they didn't hit with runners in scoring position. He hated pitchers who couldn't throw the ball over the plate. And you could feel that to the degree that I would sometimes turn on the radio when I was in the car with my kids. And John would, I could hear his voice, and then I would say to them, oh, the Yankees are losing. And my son, Jake, he'd be like, what are you talking about? He hasn't given the score yet. I said, no, promise, they're losing. Because I could hear in his voice, Taylor, he'd be so angry that his Yankees were behind in games. He was like a disappointed parent. So I understand why people felt like he was over the top with that game-ending call, you know, if you're on the other side of it. But I always thought he told you exactly what was going on.
Don't you want your local announcer to be a little bit of a homer? I mean, well, I think that's kind of a lame complaint from other fan bases.
You could
say he's annoying, but to be like, oh, he's too much of a homer. Like, he's a Yankee employee. Like, what? Or I guess he's, you know, employee of the radio, but basically a Yankee employee. You know, if you're a fan, you don't want to hear a guy who's just going to poop on your team throughout the broadcast.
And you also want to hear someone who's honest.
Yes, of course.
Yep. We're not playing well. You know, we stink with runners in scoring position. All the things that John would say, he was really direct. All right. So we got feedback from listeners about the best calls of his career. And one of them actually was when John was broadcasting for WTBS in Atlanta, this absolutely insane game that took place between the Mets and the Braves. It went, I think, in the end, like 17 innings. It was in the middle of the night. It was rain delayed. They wound up shooting off fireworks at the end of the game because it was 4th of July at like 4:30 in the morning. But during this insane game, because the Braves had run out of players, they sent reliever Rick Camp up to hit, to be used as a pinch hitter. Give a listen to this.
Now two outs and no one on. The Mets are waving their outfielders in. It'll be an 0-2 pitch. And he hits it to deep left. Heat goes back. It is gone. Holy cow. Oh, my goodness. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Rick Camp. Rick Camp. I don't believe it.
That was completely appropriate for that game, Taylor. That wild, it's known as the Rick Camp game. Even though the Braves actually wound up losing that game, for him to be set up as a pinch hitter, and John, before that, he said something along the lines of, this will certify this is the craziest game ever if Rick Camp hits a home run, and that's exactly what he did.
Bring the infielders in, man. That was a great, great touch by the Mets there. Really put the whole thing over the edge.
Yeah, the outfielders all were like standing right behind the bases like, yeah, this guy can't hit. And he had a terrible swing on the first two pitches. He drives it out of the park. All right. One of the signature calls that he had for players was that for Bernie Williams.
No one on. Bottom of the eighth. 1-0 Seattle. It'll be a 3-2. Swung on and hit high in the air to deep right. That ball is high. It is far. It is gone. Bernie goes boom. He drills a home run the short way in the right field seats. Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah, so that was his call for Bernie Williams in Old Yankee Stadium. In the 2001 World Series, Tino Martinez tied the game in the bottom of the ninth inning with a two-run homer. Well, the very next night, the Yankees went on to win that game. The very next night, the same situation. The Yankees were down two runs. Bottom of the ninth inning, runner on base. Scott Brosius at the plate.
Posada is the base runner, so Brosius, of course, the tying run with two outs in the bottom of the ninth. Now Kim, 1-0. Swung on and hit in the air to deep left. That ball is high. It is far. It is gone. Michael said, do you believe
dozen Yankee fans here say, yes, we do.
And here was the last home run call of John Sterling's storied career.
And the pitch hit in the air to deep left. It is high. It is far. It is gone. It's a grand slam. Non dimenticar. That ball sure traveled far. Giancarlo, he hits a grand slam deep in the left field seats. And the Yankees take a 5-1 lead.
Jessica Mendoza is an analyst for ESPN, and she also serves as an analyst on Dodger broadcast. Jess, how you doing?
I'm doing awesome. Southern California day. It's actually not raining. Like, as soon as you left, the weather is now beautiful. Sun is out. It's kind of how it works.
I've been wearing my Montana gear in the two games we had with the Dodgers. It's been like a wind chill factor, like in the high 40s in the two games, which is okay with me. Like, I was fine with that. I'd rather have that than, like, your 90 to 100 degrees that you love so much. You were at Dodger Stadium on Monday night on Jackie Robinson Day. You got to witness the pregame ceremonies in which Rachel Robinson was honored. What was that like being at a Dodger game on Jackie Robinson Day?
You know, I've never been. We're always working. We're always somewhere. I've never been at Chavez Ravine on Jackie Robinson Day. And it just, what I loved about it, first of all, it was this giant tribute to Rachel Robinson, who was 101 years old. She turns 102 this year. And it was so emotional. Like, I mean, just the way the players genuinely were talking about the influence, and obviously Mookie Betts, Jason Hayward, Taylor Trammell, who's new to the Dodgers, but talked about the influence that, like, he brought up a great point. He's like, it's about paying it forward. So Jackie Robinson influenced, I mean, everyone, but obviously that next generation to say, I can now play in the major leagues, and then how it kept paying forward. He's like, then I grew up in Georgia watching Jason Hayward, seeing a black player on the field doing his thing, and that influenced me. He's like, and now to be in that dugout. And then he spent the day at UCLA at Jackie Robinson Field with hundreds of kids from inner city Los Angeles, not only teaching them the game of baseball, but they had these career stations where they taught them all the different things that they can do in life beyond baseball, which I was like, and to listen to Taylor describe this, Mookie Betts to describe this, I mean, they were emotional talking about how important it is to pay it forward. And ultimately, that's what Jackie wants, is not to look back, but to continue to look forward.
So, Jess, I got to cover, when I was at the New York Times in 1997, I was covering the Mets at that time. And so I was there on April 15th, 1997, the first Jackie Robinson Day. What I remember was that the sport itself, I think, was trying to figure out what this day was going to mean. You know, Bud Selig, to his credit, started this day, but the whole thing about the players all wearing the numbers, that wasn't the case at the beginning, right?
It was Griffey, right?
It was scattered, right? Exactly. Yeah. And then as time has gone on, I think it has been something that people really look forward to.
Yeah, no, and I was looking into more of, and I didn't realize how, like, Griffey was like, he got Rachel Robinson's permission to flip his number at 24 and wear 42. And then that became his thing every time it was Jackie Robinson Day. And then it became this aha, took him like 10 more years, but then it was like, let's have everybody, you know, wear this number. And it gives me goosebumps every time. And you see it just across, you know, I was videotaping actually with my phone. So, you know, we're coming on air and I'm like, I've got to videotape this. So we're talking, coming on air.
Wait, Jess, you're late on going on air? That's a shock to me.
Oh, no.
Somebody worked with you.
The best is I'm actually live on air still talking with my phone, recording it myself, because I'm like, I want this. You know, I want to understand. And to be honest, I pushed our producers to show a lot of, you know, Jackie Robinson in D.C. with Martin Luther King Jr. You know, My son is in D.C. right now. And I just wanted to remind people, I think people forget how the activism continued. And, you know, we talk so much about on the field, the hatred. I know you talked about it in your podcast with the Reds and Pee Wee Reese and just all the things that happened. But he got so much hate afterwards because of the civil rights movement and how much he stood by that. How many players, Buster, do you know when they are big names, they retire and they're like, okay, I'm done. you know, right. Don't get involved in politics. Don't get involved in anything. And in this case, in the special time when it was like right and wrong, clearly he became the most active person of any African-American player. And I feel so proud to be able to talk about that as well.
I got to meet Rachel Robinson, I want to say about 9 years ago at Yankee Stadium on opening day. That was really cool. I mean, what a super nice person. And that's neat. And you were saying that it was very emotional as people honored her on Monday.
Yeah, Magic Johnson emceed it. And the whole entire thing was called Dear Rachel. And I had tears in my eyes because it was Billie Jean King. You know, it was Mookie, it was Jason. It was, you know, Dr. Harry Edwards. I mean, the people they brought out for this thing, and they all started with Dear Rachel. And this is what you did to provide, to be the woman behind Jackie Robinson and continuing this on through his foundation. And I mean, it was unbelievably impactful and honestly unique. And it was like, thank you, Rachel, for continuing this on and being the person that you are. And Mookie talked very much about him and his wife, and saying that that is the marriage that they look to, because it's, you know, it's not easy sometimes, and how much he admires what Rachel and Jackie had.
Well, that's really neat that you got to experience that. I'm really glad. You also got to see the Dodgers play the Washington Nationals. The Nationals, look, I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. They're not going to win their division. But when we talk about teams improving this year, you know, Royals, Guardians, Nationals are in that group. You're starting to see elements of a team that's going to be really dangerous for, in a, you know, 2 or 3 years. I think the number one guy in that regard is CJ Abrams.
Absolutely. And they are a fun team to watch. I know they're up and down, but anytime you get young players that are just taking hacks, look, I know it's not, I get it. The analytics show you how to play the game, how to take your at-bats, but CJ Abrams at the top of their order literally epitomizes exactly what the Nationals are going to be, because how he goes, they go. And a lot of it has to do with his aggressiveness. He's that kid that literally just loves to hit, and you can feel it. You can feel the confidence shift for him, Buster, because before he did chase, but it was like a lack of confidence. It was a doubt. It was a question mark. Ever since coming over from San Diego, being the guy on the flip side of a trade with Juan Soto, you know, I felt like he just felt so much pressure and never really quite felt at home. Talking with Davey Martinez, talking to so many of his teammates yesterday, it's like he's arrived. He's finally woke up and been like, you know what? This is home. This is my home, and I'm going to lead this team and kind of have that swag. And really everything people saw early on with CJ is now coming to light. He had a home run, a double against Tyler Glasnow, no less. And you should have seen some of the pitches he was swinging at. There was not a pitch in the zone that he did not want to hit. And that tells me he's got confidence.
Well, and it's interesting because he is, I think he's a classic case of a player where people watch him play when he's a teenager and say, boy, that guy can really play shortstop, but will he ever be able to hit? It's pretty clear he's going to be a, you know, a guy who could potentially hit 30 home runs in a season. He looks, we had the Nationals at the Little League Classic last year, and to see him now, even compared to last summer, you see how much he's filling out.
Yes. No, he's getting after it, like with understanding. You know, I think when you're traded like that, I think it's hard for all of us to really understand what that's like. And I think he was really just trying to find himself, and now he has. And it's not just his physique, it's his voice. Watching him on the field, Buster, he's constantly talking. He was doing jumping jacks in like the sixth inning. Like, I mean, just out there, like, having fun, right? Like reminding us all, like, this game is fun. And when you are having fun, you're going to do well.
All right. The Dodgers all year, because we assume they're going to be in the postseason all year with the Dodgers, it feels like a lot of the conversation is, hey, let's try to find the warts on this team early on, bullpen and the bottom third of the lineup. You can pick one of those and give me some thoughts on one of the warts the Dodgers have shown early.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bullpen's the one that stands out to me the most just because of how dramatically different it is from last year. You know, when I think about like what allowed their starting pitchers, that they went through so many injuries and was really their weakness last year. I mean, honestly, the reason why they struggled, especially as they got to the postseason, but even in the games that they lost, a lot of it had to do with the fact that they couldn't get length from their starting pitchers. They couldn't get guys to stay on the field. So they relied on their bullpen. Their bullpen won them so many games. And they were coming in like pitching 6 innings a game, 5 innings a game. I mean, right. It wasn't simple. So that to me has been, you know, there's now pressure on the starting pitching. And by the way, Walker Buehler, it looks like he's going to be coming back, you know, very soon. He's going out. I think he's pitching tomorrow or a couple days to be able to.
Thursday. Yeah, he's starting Thursday after taking that ball up his middle finger a few days ago in a rehab start.
Exactly. So he'll be, you know, back out there. So you start to think about their rotation and, you know, if these guys are able to stay healthy, they get more guys back. How is this bullpen going to shake out? Because you can't just hand it to Evan Phillips, you know, in the sixth. Right. So they brought up a new guy, Ricky Benasco, actually threw two innings, scoreless, looked really good, super confident. And I think that's what they're doing. They're bringing up a few more guys, I think, over the next week and a half to be able to try them out, you know, because they understand that this bullpen cannot be what it is right now, that they are going to look at a variety of different arms and find this as at least a way to get them through and allow their starters to not have to feel that pressure.
Nice. What do you think about the bottom third of the order? Because, I mean, Chris Taylor's struggling and Kike Hernandez has struggled and others have struggled. It has been, you know, as great as the top third of the lineup has been, the bottom third has really been a sinkhole at the beginning of this year, surprisingly.
Yeah, I shouldn't say it's not super surprising, but I think with the attention that the top third gets, and then honestly, the fact that the middle third gets ignored. I mean, Max Muncy has been their biggest, like, shining light, and Will Smith, you know, that come after the big three in Betts, Ohtani, and Freeman. So Will Smith, you know, Teo, Max Muncy, those, the middle third has actually been what's kind of, I feel like, been the blessing, knowing that the bottom third has struggled. My thing is, you know, guys like James Outman that can be extremely streaky. Chris Taylor, you know, I think he is like, he's not just struggling, but I think mentally you can see he's just down on himself. Gavin Lux is a better hitter than what he's showing. And I think that part, just to be able to get Mookie, like, people on base. I mean, Mookie's coming up starting off innings more often than not. And this lineup has more depth than what it's showing right now.
Yeah, no question about it. All right, Jess, thanks for doing this. Always great to catch up.
Yes, thank you.
Bleacher Tweets.
Already Buster Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. You can call the Bleacher Tweets voicemail box at 406-404-8460. That number is in the show notes. You can email the show, bleachertweets@gmail.com, and you can write us on X, hashtag Bleacher Tweets. We've got a couple voicemails, we've got a couple emails, we've got a couple tweets. I got to shout out my guy, Stuart Rosenbaum from Long Island. He sent that Scott Brosius home run. I know lots of people did, but he is my it Buster. I know you know the Yankees. You reported on them for years, but my guy Stuart is the authority in my life on all things Yankees. So when he sent that highlight in, I knew that it was a good one and we had to play it.
Yeah, had to play it. Plus, you know, that World Series, you've heard me say this before, that was really one of the probably will go down as the most remarkable event that I ever covered as a reporter.
No doubt. I told you before, I went down a rabbit hole watching clips. I was watching clips of that World Series. Thrilling stuff. I'm sure it was exciting to be there. Let's go to the voicemails here.
Hi, my name is Patrick Pogel, and I live in Dothan, Alabama. Diehard Yankees fan here. Question for Buster for this evening. I lived through the 90s dynasty era of the New York Yankees. So many of my friends were Braves fans during that era. And, of course, we know how they only had the one championship in that decade. I'm curious as to your thoughts as to why that pitching staff, with them being as elite and as great as they were, only managed to win that one championship. Love the show, and thanks for all you guys do.
Yeah, that's a tough life to be in Alabama as a Yankee fan, I'm sure. So, yeah, very brave of you. Look, I always felt this way, that the difference between the Yankees and the Braves was Mariano Rivera. That so often in the postseason, the Braves would, they had that great rotation and then they would have a thin bullpen and they didn't have Mariano Rivera. Mariano Rivera was the difference between the Yankees and a lot of teams during that time, which is why when I did the book on it, I put him on the cover because to me, he was the most important player. He was the difference maker for those years. Does that make sense, Taylor?
Yep. And you always say he's on your Mount Rushmore of Yankees. And I feel like a lot of people will skip over that. But I mean, your point is very compelling.
Hey, Buster and Taylor, this is Chris from Durham, North Carolina, a huge fan of the show. My dad is a big White Sox fan, has been his whole life. And one of the things I love about the show is you guys like to keep it positive. So seeing how David Schoenfield just declared the White Sox historically bad, I'm wondering if you could name three things about the White Sox that should make White Sox fans optimistic about their future, because today will be better than yesterday. Thanks, guys.
Oh, man. All right. So three things. Well, I'd say this. Like, number one, Chris Getz, who took over as general manager last year, he's really respected within the industry. Like, people think he's really adept. And he's so the fact that, you know, they made a change and they bring in this guy who folks with other teams think is going to be really good, that is obviously a good sign. I like Andrew Vaughn. I think he's a really good player. And someone who, once you surround him with other good players, he's going to be good. And we've been talking about Garrett Crochet, right? It feels like we've done like three segments on Garrett Crochet and how good he's been at the beginning of this season. So there are three things.
I'll add four. Pedro Grifol. We've been talking about him a lot. You like him. You know, maybe he sticks around. You know, the product improves and he gets to make a mark there.
I hope so. If he winds up getting fired because of this mess, and I think there's a fair chance at the end of the year, at least, that that happens, we'll never know how good he was as a manager, because he just, you know, the cards are stacked against him from the beginning.
Hey, Buster and Taylor, this is Jake from Pennsylvania, diehard Pirates fan. My question is about Paul Skeens. The Pirates are saying that he's in the minor leagues to work on developmental. Three starts, 9 1/3 innings, and 19 strikeouts. Do you feel that the Pirates are just putting him in the minors to do service time manipulation, or do you think they really have anything they are particularly working on? Thanks. Love the show. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I think they're holding him down a month, and then they can delay his free agency by 1 year. And it was interesting. I was watching the broadcast last night, and who was it? Oh, it was Dan Plesac, actually, in the MLB Network, made that same point. He was like, yeah, they're leaving him down. He's going to hit a date, and then they'll call him up. But there's no question. Right now, he's one of the 10 best pitchers in the organization.
All right, we got a couple emails here, some observations. Nick Bowman, longtime listener from Harbin, China. He said he loves to watch games at 7 a.m. He said, I heard Buster talking about pitchers on bad teams not being fantasy relevant. He said, how about DeGrom, Doc Holliday on the Jays, Dontrell Willis, excellent fantasy seasons on bad teams. So counterpoint to you, Buster.
Yeah, fair point, all that. I just worry, and I guess it wasn't as specific as they should have been. Not only is he a pitcher on a bad team, so quite literally from a fantasy perspective, you're probably not going to get wins, but also he's pitching in that bandbox of a ballpark. It's a great hitter's park. A lot of odds stacked against Garrett Crochet. But I did pass on Sarah's concern to my son, Jimmy Johnson, and told him to get it right.
Oh, my God. Joe Peters writes in, hey guys, I love the show. Very sad to hear that John Sterling has retired. Not even a Yankees fan. He said, one of my all-time favorite podcast segments was from several years ago when you guys did John Sterling impressions for fictional home run calls. I had not been familiar with his work up to that point as a non-Yankees fan, but became enamored with him since, in honor of his great career. He asked for favorite John Sterling calls, but we've already covered that. But a non-Yankees fan grew to love John Sterling from the show and these fictitious home run calls. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we had fun. And, you know, the great thing about John, and again, you know, he's really such a nice and fun guy. And so many people around the team were tweeting about that yesterday. When I brought him that list of the fictitious home run call, he just dove into it. Like, I know announcers, you know announcers who would have just, you know, the nose would have gone in the air. They would have sniffed and walked away. And John just dove right into it.
Let's go to the tweets. Andrew Stout, he wants to know if your career ever, he says your career barely overlapped with Whitey Herzog. Did you ever talk to him, interview him?
Just one conversation. I had the same experience so many other writers did. They loved him. You know, I defer to someone like Peter Gammons, who was tweeting this morning that in his mind, Whitey Herzog was the smartest talent evaluator that he ever met.
Let's go to Brian Simpson. Yo, B. Simp writes in, hey, Buster, where's the love for Jackson Merrill in Rookie of the Year voting? Go Padres.
So I met him the other day in the Padres dugout. Man, does he have confidence? Mike Schilt, before that game, said to us that, and he made it very clear, look, he's not comparing him in terms of what he's going to accomplish to Derek Jeter, but he said the mental makeup is very similar to Jeter's in that he believes that his confidence is so strong that he just knows he's going to figure out a way to succeed. And you could feel that. He's also, for 20 years old, like, he's this tall, rangy kid. He actually reminds me of Christian Yelich when he was young.
Ooh, I like the comp. Like the comp. Last one here, Debbie Gammons Brown, DGB, our friend. She writes, what's your baseball watching routine when you're at home in Montana, Buster?
So the nice thing is, I like the fact that, you know, for me, the afternoon games get started like 11 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
Right. And you can fill up the day. And then the night games start 4:30. And so that'll be on. And then, and then my partner Liz gets back and then we'll wind up, maybe if the Red Sox are on, she might watch that. She's a big Red Sox fan, a big Rafael Devers fan. And then we'll probably have dinner and then go back and watch a little bit more before we go to bed.
So that's interesting. So I'm kind of in the same boat. I like to watch games, but you know, it's a balance with your significant other. Like they're probably not going to watch baseball all the time. Does Liz ever give you a hard time and say, hey, let's turn on Below Deck here. I'm over baseball.
Well, for sure, Mom, I'm just, I do the preemptive strikes on that one, right? Uh-huh. Where you just know, oh man, there's this great movie that you and I have been talking about. Let's watch that one on Netflix.
Uh huh. Gotcha. All right. It's a delicate dance. I love it. Well, obviously.
Yeah. And you got to read the room.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, to quote our friend Kyle Schwarber, you got to read the room.
All right. Thanks for writing in. Thanks for calling in, everyone. Shout out Andrew Campbell in Portland, Levi in Oregon, Coach Sorensen and Preston Baker in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks for calling in, guys. Keep the calls and the tweets and the emails coming. We will be back on Friday.
Now, that's it for today. My thanks to Christian Yelich, to Jessica Mendoza, to Paul Hembikides, to Taylor Schwenk, and of course, to John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.